Well, I have to be honest, so far we haven't had any incidents involving deepfakes. I think we need to move to the next level and say, okay, how can we practice a deepfake? How can we then recognize a deepfake through a video of a CFO or CEO? On one hand, we need technologies that allow watermarking of real, verified content. We must also counteract with communication, training, and processes.
Welcome to Cybersecurity Shall Be C-Level Priority, the podcast that puts the digital world to the test. Cyber attacks are on the rise, and data is the most valuable asset in today's world. But how can we protect what matters most to us? Drawing on the latest insights, effective strategies, and practical tools, we'll show you how to create a more secure digital environment. Because one thing is clear, security isn't negotiable. It's a top priority.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Cybersecurity Executive Matter, the podcast. Today, not in my studio again, but with a special guest, because today we are visiting Julia. And Julia has kindly invited me into her sacred halls. But before we start talking about where we actually are, Julia, first of all, thank you very much for having me here. And maybe for everyone who doesn't know you yet, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I should be the one thanking you, and good day to everyone. I think Nico and I have tried several times to find this appointment, and I'm so happy that you are here with me in Duisburg today, specifically at Haniel. What should I say about myself? Haniel is one of the most traditional companies in Germany. We currently have 10 companies in our portfolio. That means business is very diverse. And my role as Group CSO is to find the cybersecurity standards that unite us all and help us continuously improve.
And actually, that's not just your main job, but what else do you do much, much more of? And that's also how we got to know each other. It's actually your work in the public sphere, especially for women in cyber and many other areas that fascinate me, where one can see your passion, and which also led me to say, hey, Julia, I have to finally meet her in person. I've seen so much already, but never met in person. That's why I'm even more pleased that we managed to do it today. And what we've also noticed is that every time we've met, both over the phone and today in person, we've actually already started talking, even though we haven't even made a podcast yet. That's true. So we have so many things we can talk about and so many topics.
Maybe there will be an uncut version.
Maybe we'll make an uncut version. Who knows? That's why today there isn't a real structure where we say we have only one main topic, but we want to talk about various topics because we've just noticed, especially since you've been in Davos and also in Munich, how has that changed? The cyber, what is there in relation to AI? A topic close to both our hearts is also, what are we actually doing in Germany? Also in relation to the topic of cybersecurity, those were our rough ideas, and let's just see where it leads us.
Yes, honestly. On the way to our podcast, on the way to Duisburg, I also thought it's a challenging task to talk about things today because right after the weekend, the world will change. For us, for everyone, for Germany. And thus it is very exciting what we are discussing today, but I believe this is the moment where we can and should speak our truth. We should definitely live our rights, democratic values, and of course, go surfing on the weekend. At the same time, the question is, what does all this have to do with cybersecurity? It has a lot to do with cybersecurity. In Munich, I had the opportunity to exchange with our community. And what greatly concerns me, first of all, is this spread of unverified information and at a speed that is no longer humanly stoppable. I'll give an example. A piece of misinformation can be spread 87 times per second. If we as cybersecurity or information security specialists do not counteract this, what will the world, what will democracy mean tomorrow? And it has also been observed that the major social media outlets are reducing the regulation or at least the filtering of fake news. And here I say, why are we sitting here together? We are sitting here together so that we can also tell the larger community about it and say, please, pay attention to what you read, pay attention to what you see. In the past, a video was proof that something had happened. Today, one must look at videos, photos, and possibly newspaper articles with a completely different perspective and say, okay, am I being self-critical? Could this be the truth? Constantly questioning.
Have you ever dealt with deepfakes, which is a topic you just mentioned in your work? So, have you already encountered deepfakes? Have you been affected by deepfakes?
Well, I have to be honest, so far we haven't had any incidents involving deepfakes. Of course, there are reports from the industry, from those working in similar industries to ours. For example, in Hong Kong, 25 million was released through a faked team call. And the question is, how do we prepare our employees for something like this? Interestingly, I learned about a German startup in Munich that is developing training measures based on deepfakes. Builds. That means it's not about phishing. Everyone knows about phishing by now. I think we need to move to the next level and say, okay, how can we practice a deepfake? Practice. How can we then recognize a deepfake through a video of a CFO or CEO? And it made me very happy that there are companies in Germany researching such very modern and very relevant topics.
But do you see this topic for yourself? Deepfake? That was actually the background of my question. Many people always talk about deepfakes. And I also say that deepfakes are a very, very important point. That it has actually already happened in a company is rather rare. But now is the time to take measures. And for me, a measure is also thinking about how I communicate at all. And that actually brings us to our main topic. Communication is the key. How do I communicate the whole thing? How do I deal with it? For me, one aspect is the topic of raising awareness. But the other is also, how can I prevent something like this, for example, by simply incorporating something like a code word? By saying, hey, when I'm on the phone with someone, the code word is simply frog. Simple example. But do you also see, in quotes, that we need to move in this direction? Or do you think we should rather focus on technologies that can detect deep fakes?
I believe we absolutely need to work from both sides. On one hand, we need technologies that allow watermarking of real, verified content. Of course, we have a European AI regulation that tells us AI regulation. So produced, generated content should be clearly labeled. I believe this is also a protection for consumers, a protection for generations that may not have grown up with AI. That's something great. If it's not too complex and doesn't have too much bureaucracy, but overall, I think it's going in a very good direction. And at the same time, we must also counteract with communication, training, and processes. Only together does it make sense. We cannot rely solely on technology.
How do you see it right now? Since you mentioned you were in Davos and now in Munich, how is the EU and specifically Germany handling it? Because on these topics, do you see a difference between the EU and Germany?
Well, what I clearly perceived in Davos is a spirit of optimism. There was a lot of positivism, rather, against the possibilities of AI to perceive. There were discussions about what we can do, implementing great things with AI. For example, we can finally get to know our brains and understand how everything works. We can finally cure incurable diseases. We can also research climate change and the preservation of life. These are such great examples of how AI can help us. And when I returned to Germany, I was really inspired. And I thought, my God, things are really taking off. It's going to be great. And then after the Munich cybersecurity conference, the mood was more like, beware, AI can also cause harm. Beware, we need to counteract. And I found Eva Meidel's lecture fantastic because she said that regulation in the right doses is incredibly important. It's like wearing a seatbelt in a car. No one would currently buy a car without a seatbelt. And that's exactly how I see it with AI. If it's necessary, if it protects us, it's good and right. At the same time, she also said that writing a regulation and making it available to the world is not the same as implementing a regulation, and we need more help there. Especially with smaller, medium-sized companies, with startups in Germany. Not to stifle them with regulations, but to say, we are here, we help you take the safe path.
There, you address an important topic for me. Especially when we talk about regulation, it's also about how do I implement regulations. I recently had a great discussion about this where someone told me, hey, regulation also means, it doesn't mean you have to implement it this way, but you also have a certain degree of freedom. But that's exactly where I see the problem for myself, having this freedom, because if I don't know how to implement it and then have freedom, what do I do then? And I always find that challenging, especially when you mention startups or companies where the core business isn't AI, but they want to use AI to perhaps do more business, create new business. To do things wise, differently, whatever it may be, that might also need AI to survive, but then they deal with these issues, have to deal with them and then come back to a problem. And then again, the topic I always mention, usability versus security. Then they say, okay, for me, the issue of security is not that important because I want to use the thing. And then you forget something again, and then you gain nothing through regulation. Do you see that other European countries are doing it differently? That is that other countries do not regulate as strictly or do not set such a path or set a stronger path that makes it easier to follow or implement.
Honestly, hand on heart, I don't see a way yet, but I see the first tender steps, little plants that are meant to grow in that direction. Two important topics. From my perspective, were also addressed at the Munich Cybersecurity Conference. Firstly, if we have a regulation, how do we ensure that this regulation is implementable? And that regardless of the size of the company, perhaps, I'll make a comparison now, which will be very clear in the German-speaking area with swimming. There is a gold badge. At the moment, we are demanding a gold badge even from a non-swimmer. How about we start with a swimming certificate and now translate it into cybersecurity standards with minimum standards? For smaller, iron, medium-sized companies, for startups, perhaps such a swimming certificate is enough to say, yes, we are secure enough, and this way we can start swimming with the big ones and simultaneously develop ourselves. The bigger you get, the more critical it becomes. The more critical the applications become, the stricter the standards also become.
I also find that absolutely legitimate because the other point is, yes, also that much of what is already included in the AI Act and is supposed to be implemented is not yet possible. So if you also look at the other side, which comes from the regulatory level, the AI office, officer, and everything that was in the AI Act, which is not yet fully in place, it also means that you can't do everything yet. And I've always been a fan of just doing something, just starting to do something. Where to begin? So not always immediately going for this 100% solution, as you say, aiming for the gold badge, first do the little things, see how good I am with the little things, and then maybe go for silver, and then maybe go for gold, instead of always favoring gold right away.
Exactly. And I believe if we only have gold in mind, it can scare some companies and they might say, this regulation is just a nuisance. We should make the regulations more accessible. Then say, okay, wonderful, the little things are actually just two or three steps. And then you're already well secured. Of course, I'm simplifying it. But this step-by-step model, I think that would be great. And the second topic that was addressed at the Munich Cybersecurity Conference is collaboration. Collaboration among us cyber professionals, but also collaboration between public and private sectors, meaning public and companies. Decades of SMEs, corporate startups, that we form an ecosystem and say only together are we strong. We know the cybersecurity market is growing. This is a great opportunity. At the same time, cyber criminals are the third largest economy in the world. So somehow we have to keep up. And we can only keep up if we share information with each other, if we also share the same standards and expectations with each other.
I think that's a great topic because that's exactly the reason why I'm doing this podcast and why I've been addressing these public issues for years. Because I always say, people, let's exchange ideas, let's not. have this mindset of you are now my applicant or my competitor, whatever, because together we can all do something good for cybersecurity. But what is your personal feeling? Is it really being recognized? Because my personal feeling is unfortunately still that, although it has changed significantly in recent years, that there is already more collaboration out of necessity because there is no other way, because there are no resources, there is no possibility. So you slowly notice that alliances are being formed, but it is still far from being able to speak of an active exchange.
As I said, I perceive the first positive signs. And indeed, there are groups where the CISOs in Germany unite and at least exchange information. What is currently happening? What are the new vulnerabilities? What tactics, what strategies do we have to uncover them? And especially with vulnerabilities, I think it would be great and helpful for everyone if we could talk about IOCs as early as possible. Because we all know the number of zero-day attacks is increasing. The statistic I have seen now is that 70% of attacks come through 0 days. But that feels initially illogical. One would think, my God, you would rather exploit existing known vulnerabilities. No, actually, the 0 day is the trend. And with 0 day, it's important to uncover it as quickly as possible. What are the symptoms? I always compare it. Cyber is like medicine. During the corona pandemic, we first understood and brought it to a positive trend when we released the tests. We said, these are the clear symptoms. Something is happening. And exactly the IOCs, if we can talk about IOCs as quickly as possible and share them with a broader community, that would be the first right step.
I believe here too, one must always say that sharing this knowledge should not be perceived as being weak or having done something wrong. We are back to my favorite topic, error tolerance in Germany. And I think it also has a bit to do with, because people don't want to admit their mistakes. But as you said, against 0 day, yeah, what can you do about it? You simply can't do anything about it.
The only thing you can do is say, I have a solution.
Exactly.
I know how you handle those 0 days. You can identify, share it with everyone.
Exactly. And there, I believe we need to get to the point where it's recognized that for these things, we need this collective intelligence. We need all the companies that also know and share together, because it can only be used to our advantage. And it's just not like I'm showing vulnerability to someone else just because I say I've been hacked. But that is also, I believe...
May I jump on this train of thought? Yes. The stigma of sharing that one has been hacked needs to go away. Because cyber criminals also play on that. Would anyone be ashamed to go to the police if they were finally robbed? If a door has been broken into, if a window has been smashed, you immediately call the police and say, look, I've had an incident, help me. With cyber incidents, it's strangely different. I always compare it to fire accidents. Has anyone seen a headline in the last 5 years that a company has burned down to the ground? Probably not, because with a fire, you call for help. For a fire, we have developed very specific measures. Fire extinguishers are hanging everywhere. We need to reach the same perception and say, cyber security is safety. Digital safety, personal safety is essentially the same. And if we look at the trends again, we have a hybrid warfare approach, hybrid war. That means the cybersecurity incidents are so connected with the physical world, with the disruption, that society can no longer ignore it and be ashamed of it. We should talk about it.
I think that's a super strong approach. And I also find it, especially as you described it, super important, because I always say we need something similar to fire drills for cyber. No one debates fire drills. Why are we still debating cyber drills? But to stick with this example, because this is always a huge controversy for me, even among us experts. I already know 10 different opinions that will be written below saying, no, Nico, I see it this way, or no, Nico, I see it that way. But there is the faction that says, yes, we need to talk about these cybersecurity attacks because otherwise we wouldn't discuss it and the topic would eventually die out. And there is the faction that says, no, don't talk about it anymore, because in the end, it's fear-mongering and we don't make any progress. I think, again, it's about the dosage. I think we definitely need to talk about it because we must not forget it. we must not forget that such things happen. And I think, especially the topic of lessons learned, or as some say, lessons not learned, that should actually be the goal of such communication. I'm not a fan at all of bashing companies. It doesn't help any company or a chamber of commerce or the next municipal utility or the next municipal company that has been hacked again and everyone piles on again. That doesn't help anyone either. But I think we always need to ensure that we can create a balance here to see how we can generate a lessons learned from this information, the atmosphere, and the technology. Also generate a lessons learned for those involved. And I agree with you. But it also doesn't help to say that we have to report on it all the time, because then it won't work anymore either. So then, in quotes, you will eventually have it. At some point, people will tune out and say, well, now there are another 20 reports about hackers. Now I'm the next one. Yeah, what am I supposed to do about it? I don't feel like it either. And we already had the same topic in the preliminary discussion, the topic of the federal election. Yes, the federal election is important, and yes, everyone should go vote. But what happens if I stress it out like this and do nothing else 24/7? Then I can also end up going in the opposite direction, where people say, okay, I'm not interested in the topic anymore because I'm communicating too much about it.
Yes, exactly, like information fatigue or a certain weariness. What is important in communication about cybersecurity is to put it in context. Because I believe many citizens have a vision or idea that cybersecurity takes place somewhere in the basement, in dark rooms. And if there's an incident, then in an emergency, a few IT people work over the weekend and then everything is fine again at some point. And the context for a cybersecurity incident can be that a city with hundreds of residents, 100,000 residents, can be without heating in the deep winter. Especially where NIS2, a law that was supposed to protect not only critical infrastructure, but also other quite important industries, unfortunately did not come into being. And when we communicate about it and say, everyone can be affected by it. If the family is sitting in the cold or has no electricity to somehow prepare dinner, then it certainly affects everyone. And one should indeed consider this hybrid approach. If we have an incident in the digital world, it will radiate into the physical one. And the extent can, of course, be critical. Now, back to your topic, we should not do this as fear-mongering, but I would rather do it in an activating way, so that citizens also go to municipalities and ask, is our facility secure? Are my data secure? Do we have investments? Are we doing it in the right place?
That's a great contribution. I once had someone who did it in Reykjavik and explained this whole e-governance to me. So Flurigan was a great topic. For those interested, feel free to watch the episode. And that was exactly it, because I asked, how can it be that you do everything digitally? And we are not doing that at all, and we always just talk about privacy. And he also said we were transparent from the beginning. We communicated transparently. Did it go wrong or is it a mistake? Happened. And people came to us and said, guys, what have you done there? And is what you're doing safe? So there was a much greater interaction. Yes, I know. People will say again, yes, you can do that in Reykjavik. Much smaller. Can't be compared to Germany. And so on. It's just a small island. Yes, all well and good. I can understand that. But the approach or the method behind it can certainly be transferred to Germany.
Yes, and again, step by step. We don't have to start with all of Germany directly, but country by country, municipality by municipality, start a small movement. Something I would say Germany for sure. Germany, but surely. Exactly. What comes to mind here is the topic of AI. I would like to talk about that again, because I think it's also a good bridge. We are now seeing many tools in the news that bring incredible potential. Just last night, something big was introduced by Elon Musk. It should again bring the next level of efficiency. I always wonder with these developments to what extent cyber and such are involved.
That can't possibly work. I mean, that's also what I ask myself every time when you look at how fast this market operates. And we both know what security software development means, and that it's often taken as the thing that hinders progress. I recently had a recording with Jasmine where we talked a bit about the topic, emphasizing that it's never a hindrance and that there's always a way to do it agilely. I don't like the word agile, but to use agility. But it does require a bit of a process and also some lead time. And I think such things are often done quickly. And we want to show presence now. We want to seize the momentum now and so on. And I can't imagine that security is prioritized in such cases.
That reminds me of a saying. When they say, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with the team. And that's exactly what we wanted to talk about regarding cybersecurity, or maybe also AI. If you want to go fast, go without cybersecurity. Perhaps if you want to go far truly sustainably over years, that the tool also is not just hyped in the media for 2 or 3 months, but actually verifiable, trustworthy, delivers results, then you actually need security by design. Now I've mentioned another buzzword, security by design. Is that actually what you will be doing in the future? Just a myth?
Well, not for me. I always say very clearly for myself, that's how we have to live. I mean, I come from OT where it's something completely different anyway. There, security by design is already the state of the art, I would say. State of the art? The wrong word, I'm confusing it again. But it should be standard, so to use it in other areas. And I would say it's difficult in the normal IT sector. So I think a lot is still solved in IT through technology. Really, through this topic, I do security with technology and not inherently. And especially when I look into a completely different area, when I go into BC, then we have the problem again, the cost factor. And then security is way down the list again, because security is an extra chip, extra options, encryption, whatever. Or it has to be included somewhere. We're back to the topic of IoT in the private sector or the home surveillance camera, where I don't see security by design at all.
Exactly, the topic of OT as well. Great that you mention it, because in our portfolio, I see more and more that OT should be the focus. However, when I look at the provider market now, there are not that many solutions offered in OT security. And if we look locally, how many solutions do we have from Germany?
You're bringing up a good topic, because that would also be the question I would have asked you regarding this subject, as it's a topic that's widely discussed. They say that precisely because of these regulations we have here, we can't just develop something like that. We can't just create an AI that can do everything and so on. We have a competitive disadvantage. Do you see it the same way? So, do you also see a competitive disadvantage due to the regulations we have, and that someone like Elon Musk can just develop something like that overnight, leaving us Germans behind?
I would now quote someone with whom I had the honor of speaking in Davos, namely Andrew Ng. Andrew Ng is truly the godfather of AI. He was one of the co-developers of Google's models and certainly knows more about the subject than I do. And he said that regulation actually increases momentum. Why is that? When a topic is not regulated, you first discuss what is black, what is white. Do we take black, do we take white, or is gray also allowed? As soon as it is written down, it is clear, then you can go ahead, develop, seize opportunities, and also be sure that it will still be legal. In 5 years, when the regulation comes, so that this club doesn't come back, this boomerang doesn't return. And I think it's great how he said that. Regulation, the right kind in smaller doses, is momentum, is a creative force. What we see here in Europe is that we have a lot of regulation. It's not that we don't have it. Now it doesn't fit into a coherent picture because we have too many puzzle pieces. But the question is, what should the target picture be? What are we aiming to regulate towards? That means the next step, also in response to your question, is to say, okay, what should ideal regulation look like? What do we actually want to achieve? And then maybe trim the puzzle pieces we have. Perhaps make the picture smaller, so that they really fit together and not duplicate across multiple laws, for example, distribute. From my perspective, that would be good regulation.
Okay. And now in relation to, if we move away from AI a bit, regarding Germany in general, how do you see us currently in the area of cybersecurity? We've already talked about how many people say, especially now in companies dealing with security, that they need to address this now. One aspect is, wait, which tools do I use? Which processes do I handle? And so on and so forth. And there, I repeatedly see the problem that there are simply fewer providers in the German market. Yes, there are large providers from Germany as well, but they are usually active in their specific sectors. For instance, a company from Munich, which is very active, or also in the area of something like a data diode. There are some isolated cases, but if you look at the overall picture, maybe also in your direction, do you see, especially regarding the topic of security, that Germany has the opportunity to take a leading role? Or do you think that we are currently very dependent on security from outside Germany?
A very good question. And indeed, after the Munich Cybersecurity Conference, I needed the whole weekend to digest what I heard there. And from that, an impulse arose to look into how large the European market actually is for American companies, the software manufacturers. I have now looked at all software manufacturers and had an analysis created, not focused on cybersecurity, but it's 300 billion that Americans sell to Europe in the form of software. And if you consider every procurement decision maker in large German corporations, but also smaller companies, they actually have the power over where the money is spent. Is it spent in Germany or is it spent in America? And this is also a turning point where one can say, it doesn't always have to be the biggest ones, because those will automatically be American companies. What should change so that we can also give German companies a chance to participate in such tenders? And there we probably remain with the regulations, which state that a startup cannot fulfill all of that.
Exactly. And I think that addresses the right point. Because when we talk about outsourcing, we are talking about references. We are talking about a bit management that somehow has to take care of it. We are talking about a pricing structure that as a startup, you can't really implement in some cases. This also means that as a startup, you hardly have the opportunity to participate in such things unless you have a financier or a supporter in the background.
Exactly. And that was a good discussion. I believe Mr. Sauer Essig from SAP mentioned that when large corporations like SAP, which can really employ departments for legal, main procurement, and even software selection, and they are already very busy with all the regulatory requirements we can now check, what chances do the SMEs have? What chances do the startups have? That means, Ina, I believe the way forward is to assist the startups, that in collaboration, a large company, perhaps a startup, can also develop further to say, okay, we start working with you at a basic level and ensure that in 5 years you can achieve the maturity level of a corporation. At this point, it's about co-creation. I believe we don't have much of that yet. It would be great if we could form a team with our German startups and corporates and say, we can certainly develop software products, cybersecurity products in Germany, but we also need the perspective, this business challenge from large companies like SAP, for example.
I find that a nice topic. What I can also say about it, I mean, I'm often involved with tenders, and there we have the typical problem again, which we also have on the other side with job postings. You always have to consider whether everything that is included in the tender really needs to be there. For example, I recently had a tender, which I found quite amusing. It stated a certain percentage of system availability. And when you look at the other side, there is no manufacturer that guarantees you that, or something like Pro. I also experienced this with a large corporation, which included in its penalties per cybersecurity event, not per incident. Per event, VIM, they want a coverage amount of several million for the fact that there is now an event. And then I also have people, an event is not an incident. And who guarantees me that you won't just create events yourself to finance your project? So those were certainly extreme examples. I don't want to say that every tender is like that. But I see in many tenders that a lot is built around to have the final box so that nothing else fits on the sides. But conversely, the providers then have the problem that they either have to factor in a very high risk or they have to see how they can try to get there. But then they become price-wise unattractive because on the other side, there is some provider who basically says, I don't care, I just submit. And if something happens in the end, then it's always my risk. So I see that, for example, also in this collaboration, it's always a topic when we talk about tenders that they are sometimes so highly technical or packed with so many things that you sometimes have no room to maneuver or, on another point, have to factor in so much risk that it is no longer economical for the company.
Very good point, because there we are again at the risk or error culture. On which side does the risk remain? Is it with the company that perhaps hasn't thought through everything down to the very last detail, and in the end, maybe 10% or 5% is missing? Or is it with the provider who now has to deliver 180%, even though this 180% scenario might not even occur? I would wish for us to work in phases again. As a company, we could also start by working with this provider for a year. And we can also go with the company like co-creation. And if we're missing a feature, we don't need it right now. But make sure it's perhaps on the roadmap in 6 months. And that's how you can approach it.
I think it's a great example. Because it's also a topic where I say, if you invest in a long-term partnership, you're not just investing in your wallet, because it's also a cost saving for you, you're also investing to some extent in the trust you can provide, because you can develop together with the partner. You can endure things together with the partner. I always tell our customers that we want a partnership on equal footing, where we work together, where failures and successes are shared together. And it never makes sense to talk about a contract for 1 year or 3 years. You have to consider a 5-year term because it's simply the most sensible for both sides. And I also believe that this is an appeal that should be conveyed to other companies as well. If you are looking for partners, then really consider whether a 1-year or 2-year partnership is truly sensible, because then you'll have to start all over again in the end. Or you say, okay, you take this long journey with a company, but on this journey, you can grow together. And it can always happen that along the way, one goes left or one goes right.
Absolutely. So this willingness should be there on both sides to co-develop the product, especially regarding your topic of the agile world. The world is changing so quickly. We cannot expect an entrepreneur to have 100% of the functionalities ready today, because tomorrow things might have changed again and new functionalities might need to be developed immediately. So it's more about the dialogue, about creating the products together. At the same time, in tenders, the focus is often only on selling the product. And from practical experience, I see that a product ends with the signature, not the work. That's when the work really begins, to implement such a product, to obtain services, and to have the resources to actually derive value from this product. For example, SIEM. SIEM should also be one of the regulatory requirements, like NIS2, for instance. But for a team that only has 2 or 3 colleagues, implementing SIEM can be somewhat counterproductive, because who is supposed to evaluate all these events? Who should respond to it? And therefore, my appeal is to offer it directly with managed service, so that you not only have a tool, but also a team that provides the service.
But I have to interject here, because we are a managed service provider. However, you also have to understand that it only works if you have someone on the other side who is reachable. So a provider can never take over 100% of the work, because even if they had the access,
You would never let an external party have 100% access to the system and say, do whatever you want. It is always a collaboration with the customer, and the customer or the company must also understand that I need someone who is approachable. So I agree with you, yes, we are a service, but especially with a team of two people, as you just outlined, it must also be clear that 24/7 means someone has to be reachable. Whether it's waking someone up from bed or saying, let's leave it for now and wait until the next day. Someone has to be present somewhere in the process. And I agree with you, we need to stop always talking about processes. But I also want to interject here because I see this repeatedly. You're talking about the product, and I always say that too. In service, I often see the problem that people compare apples to oranges because service is not the same as service. For example, I recently had a case. Someone purchased a seam, I snot, added a sock, and ultimately, the company received nothing more than tickets. And that was it. So tickets are simply created, a notification pops up, and they are told to handle it. And if something else is supposed to happen, then the company is responsible, and one person does it this way, another does it that way. And I believe the problem here is that companies need to engage more with the service and the service agreement or service catalog and determine which service is the right one for them. There are not just black and white options, but many differences. But you also shouldn't compare one directly with the other because they are simply completely different service models.
I can write that 100%. We have also seen examples from practice where, when reading through the contract, a company imagines how it will work and thinks, yes, that's how it will function. But in reality, the tickets just keep coming in and nothing actually gets resolved. So it's about whether when we purchase a CM or SOC, it's about detection or also about remediation. And then to your point, there should also be someone on the other side. For me, this is a topic of shared responsibility, not just with managed services, but many companies are in the process of cloud migration. And often there is a false sense of security. Now we're in the cloud, now we're secure. At the same time, I wonder if we are relying too much on the big cloud providers and what opportunities do we even have to participate? And yes, I am also co-responsible and I have the right to inquire, to audit, etc.
Super interesting topics. So I think we've learned a lot today. Especially about the differences between how it was for you in Davos and also in Munich. The final question I would ask you today, and I would simply be interested in your answer, what do you see as the next, three or four top topics for you, also personally? What can we do to, I'll pick up a slogan now, I think it's great, maybe we'll develop something from it, who knows? Make Germany safer. What would you put under the slogan, we can take the example, we are currently in the election campaign. We are campaigning for cybersecurity, something like make cybersecurity great again. What would you include under this slogan? Make Germany safer.
First of all, work together, not against each other. Move away from bashing, more towards trust. We are one country. We should trust each other. Whether you are a provider, a government agency, in the business sector, or conducting research at a university, we are all behind the same mission to make Germany safer. Secondly, after trust, have courage. Have the courage to do things differently, which might have been different in the past. For example, instead of spending a few million on an American company, maybe look at what I actually have here. In Germany, we have great talents. We have no. Number three, in all patent applications worldwide, that means we already have solutions. So just trust and implement solutions. And perhaps, Murph, lastly, stand by values. Simply stand by values. What we have built here over years of history in Europe still holds value. We must stand by this and we should also defend it, both in the digital and physical world.
I thank you.
I am definitely 100% behind it, and it was a great time here with you. As I said, I thank you for that. And with that, I would say that's it for this episode of Cybersecurity Chef Sash, the podcast. We'll hear and see each other next time. Until then, or something,